Hey everyone, thank you so much for tuning in. My name is Clint and I'm here with my good friend John Steven. So I am currently the head of security research at SemGrep. So we build an open source lightweight static analysis tool and have a premium engine with additional rules. We have an SEA product. We just launched a secrets product. And I also run the TLDRSec newsletter, which is a single place you can go to get the latest and greatest tools, blog posts, and more across many areas of security from AppSec, containers, cloud, machine learning, AI, et cetera. But I am thrilled to be here with John, who has a lot of great experience across many different areas. So yeah, John, do you mind introducing yourself?
Sure. Hi, I'm John Steven. Most people know me from being a co-CTO at Sigital. Where we focused on AppSec and building application security programs. Currently, I'm founding principal of Edify Security, my firm that invests and advises security startups, as well as Office of CISO for larger organizations who are very interested in maturing.
Yeah, and when one thing I find interesting about the history of the security industry is because it's rather small, I think there are a handful of security consulting firms sort of from with like many, many people can either count their career or like the people who mentored them. And I think obviously there's like at stake very early, but I think of the slightly newer ones, I feel like Sigital as well as maybe like ISEC Partners, Modisana, which then got acquired by NCC Group. I feel like either Sigital or NCC has their hands on a disproportionate percentage of like most people working in security today, at least anecdotally from what I've seen.
I think I counted 1,500 people through the doors, and I'm very proud of a lot of them, actually. And what's great about it is it's a community that still remains in touch on a daily or weekly basis and continues to reinforce and support each other, which, again, I'm very proud of.
Yeah, which actually brings me to how we met. So we met when I was a intern my junior year of college at Sigital in Dulles, Virginia. And I think you flew out to Case Western where I went to college because you went there as well. And that's mm-hmm. kind of how we first met. So
somehow
yeah,
it was careers in spite of that education.
Yeah. Yeah. Didn't have a strong security program, but not many did at the time. But I think, I guess one thing I wanted to say is I feel like I was very excited about security, but I didn't know almost anything about it really before that internship. And I feel like it was a really formative time for me in terms of understanding like, oh, you can do this professionally. There's a set of people who know so much about it. And really, I think just building a mental model for like the different areas of security, like understanding like web security type things in better detail. So yeah, I think it was a really formative time for me and helped me significantly in the rest of my career. You're probably feeling awkward right now because I did not mention this before the call. So I've sprung it on you and you're like, ah, feelings. But yeah, I always appreciated you and the other people I worked with for, I don't know, I feel like setting me on a good path.
That's awesome. I love the internship program. I was actually an intern. And I love internship programs like that because I think it's very easy as you gain seniority to become overconfident that you've seen everything and that you know everything. And I've never felt more that it's less possible to know everything than in today's world. There's so much breadth and so much depth in the different security disciplines that it was always thrilling to me to see young people come in who had so much drive and so much piss and vinegar about their approach, their research, their way of doing it, that to me, it was great to be paid to be around that many people who were teaching me things. And that's the way I looked at it, that I wasn't the teacher, that I was learning from everybody else, and that kind of youth and drive was so consistently challenging. I think that as people age in their career, one mistake they make is to fail to surround themselves with that kind of youth and chaos, because it's incredibly beneficial. So I appreciate you and all the others that came before and after you.
Well, thank you. I like that way of thinking about it. One specific anecdote that I wanted to share is you really liked playing darts, and there was a local bar that had a couple of dart boards. And I think I just turned 21, like midway through my internship that summer, but it's not one of those stories. So I think you and I were playing darts against another two people who were just random people who were there. And even though I was very new to darts, you were much better. Somehow we won. And the stakes were the whoever lost would buy the other people drinks. So we won. And then they were like, you know, oh, like what drink do you want? And I said, how about like pineapple juice? Because I didn't and still don't like the taste of beer. And I feel like I remember you saying, man, are you serious? but you didn't give me that much of a hard time about it, but I thought that was amusing.
Pineapple juice.
It tastes good.
Okay. An Irish pub. It's their specialty.
Exactly. Yeah, all the way from Ireland. So we're going to get into some discussions that I think are going to be really neat about like scaling security, running security programs at a broad variety of types of companies, both size and vertical and things like that. But before we do that, I thought it would be useful to give people some context about the types of companies you've worked with in the past and like the breadth of them, just so people have a flavor of like, okay, this person, you know, John thinks these things, and this is sort of the data points and experiences that might lead you to believe that. So yeah, if you could share a bit about the companies you've worked with in the past and anything relevant like that would be great.
There's a lot of snowflakeism when you talk to security practitioners, you know, oh, well, we do it this way at, you know, a particular FANG or whatever. We used to say that we've built eight of the, you know, eight largest banks security programs. You know, we've worked strategically with 30 of the top 30. We ended up at the time of our sale having, you know, decent penetration into 13 different verticals, including gaming, healthcare, insurance, auto, medical, high tech, ISV. All of these individual verticals or leaders tended to think that their environment was profoundly different and unique. And to a lot of extent, they were. But with the BSIM study, the Building Security and Maturity Model, as well as the other sort of population-based measurements that we did across literally thousands of customers with durable, you know, seven-figure relationships per customer, we saw a lot of similarity and a lot of trends in the what, but different whys or hows. And so when you hear commentary from me like, oh, when maturing organizations did X, please understand that is going to be inclusive of firms like an NVIDIA, like a Microsoft, like an Adobe, as well as like a Bank of America, you know, and like a McKesson. I don't think that there's vertical specificity to the way that you do security well.
That's interesting. Yeah, because I will say anecdotally, I feel like it's not infrequent for people to say what works in one type of company may not make as much sense in another. So I think that's neat to hear that you think there's maybe less difference than people like to think.
We're all software companies, and increasingly that software is cloud-based. Whether you're exporting, you know, pacemaker data to the cloud, or you're a car manufacturer, and a car manufacturer literally said to me, look, we're a software manufacturer. We deliver our software through custom computers that we roll out on four wheels. So software is the, you know, it's the software, stupid. Software is the key to the similarity and all these things. We're digitizing everything.
Yeah, agreed. Along those lines, one area that I'm particularly interested in is sort of application security, product security, and things like that, specifically how companies can effectively scale those efforts. Because, you know, in pretty much every company I've ever seen, there's, you know, a handful maybe of AppSec or ProdSec engineers to hundreds or thousands of developers. I think I saw some industry stats that the average is maybe 1 to 100, 1 to 200, or something like that. That may,
you know, we consistently differ. Measured security as 1% of IT, and application or software security is 1% of of security. So it's 2/100ths, two orders.
Yikes. So given being outnumbered so much in many companies, I think it's interesting to talk about how to have higher leverage impact. And when we were talking about this before this call, one theme you pointed out that I thought was really fascinating is, how can we convert security staff from sort of security testing tool babysitters to critical path delivery accelerants? And I love the accelerant. Sort of product security engineers, I think you termed it. So yeah, could you tell me a bit more about how you feel about it and what you've seen be effective?
Yeah, let's start with an arc and then dive in, right? So the key to me, and there's sort of 4 points that are related into that create this arc. First is I've seen dramatically more impact when you convert threat modeling from another vulnerability discovery whack-a-mole exercise to a strategic means of defining an approach to security and risk in your organization. When you up-level that, you're working on the right stuff. Suddenly, everybody's attitude and engagement changes. Second, turning those security people, as you mentioned, from tool and triage babysitters into critical path delivery accelerators. People asked me throughout my career, why are you so effective at selling security when I haven't been able to? And I would always answer, you cannot sell security, you can sell speed of delivery. So get on the critical path and help someone do their job, because that's how your company makes the money. That's how you get that done. Once you do those two things, you're working on the right problem, you have the right risk tolerance and posture perspective, you're on the critical path, then you can start to wield the tools that we consistently think about in security and GRC differently. You can turn application security testing and defect discovery tools from vulnerability avalanches into guardrails, which is a term that people like to use in marketing in Gartner land, but never actually get down to doing. And once you get guardrails in place, you can talk at an executive level about the paved road of delivery versus the unpaved road. And you can get from an audit perspective into an accelerant perspective from a policy and governance perspective. So those four things mutually reinforce and allow you to get and stay on the critical path as a practitioner and an individual contributor. That's really important to understand, because doing one of those things without the other is substantially less durable and effective. But we can dig into what it means to convert from babysitter to accelerant now as well. But I'll pause for a second.
Yeah. I love all of those, and I want to delve into each one. So I guess we could just start in order. So when you talk about threat modeling, one thing that stuck out to me is, or that I want to hear more about, is sort of like when do you threat model? How much do you threat model? Like, how do you think of doing that for like maximum effect? To give you one anecdote, at one customer of NCC Group, when I was a security consultant there, I think that team, pretty much any new like features or products or significant numbers of things needed to be threat modeled. So there was maybe even one or two people that were just like constantly threat modeling things all the time. And it became a bottleneck for development teams, where they were like blocked on security review before they could like start building new things. Or yeah, there's just this massive never-ending backlog.
The backlog only, model.
Yeah, it only grew. So yeah, I guess I'm curious. Yeah,
let me attack this question from, the amount of disk, that I'm recorded on talking about threat modeling is vast. So, and of course it's a very noisy space right now, but the monolithic approach is challenging to mature. There are reasons for that. There are solutions to it. Let's put that on the shelf for the second.
Yeah. By monolithic, you mean threat model everything?
Do a threat model during the design phase, stop everybody to do a diagram, to do it thoroughly across the application. If we think about it in the context of our conversation of babysitting to critical path delivery, the thing I love seeing organizations do, and that I love doing with organizations, is don't threat model an application, don't threat model infrastructure, threat model a problem. Now, what's to your point, like developers are doing a sprint plan and somebody goes, hey, so this ticket on like Azure DevOps complaining that my containers are root, like, is that an issue? Because if I run these things as non-root, it's going to take me, you know, it's going to take me 3 weeks to fix this one container. It's going to take me 3 months to fix all the containers in this tower. Like that's a quarter, you know, that's a lot of effort. What's the risk of actually running these containers as root? Threat modeling problems is a way to remain on the critical path and remain in the cadence of the delivery culture. So I tell people, especially in a practitioner role, you know, below the VP or CISO level, please fixate. Even if you're going to do a monolithic threat model because your security managers demanded of you, fixate it iteratively against the cadence of the lifecycle and against a particular problem that's you know, important to resolving the priority, resolving the effort of tickets, resolving the posture in that environment. There are plenty of examples. How are we going to add, you know, annotations to a JWT without, you know, spreading the key everywhere or, you know, creating coupling between our authentication proxy and the authoritative services? Again, you know, container or namespace privilege in Kubernetes or your container orchestration layer. There's 100 such problems to solve. And what you'll find is when you threat model those issues, there's not a lot lost, you know, from a context perspective in eschewing the enterprise and the application. And you actually answer questions that stick developers up and prevent them from delivering faster. So I think that it's challenging, and this is where security management is playing the wrong role in some cases. It's challenging to let go of that sort of requirement that you threat model every application. And there's some regulation now coming down the pike, 14028 executive order in the NIST documentation that accompanies it, that demands that. But again, focusing on those specific problems is a way for you to crack the hardest nuts that slow development and actually generate critical path value. And I think combining those two, you know, techniques is really just a home run for people. And what you'll find sometimes is that when you do that, you end up with questions, not answers. So can we run this container as root? Maybe you get that down to an answer, yes, but, or no, and here's why. In other cases, you'll come up with a situation where you realize that the development framework you're using is either brittle or it didn't take into account some aspect of the security posture that you now have a gap on. And you begin to understand this gap is going to be around here for a while unless we deal with this. And so that's okay. You know, questions or additional work that threat modeling produces then allows you to prioritize your next set of critical path work, which is closing that gap in that dev framework. And so it's a way to, again, make sure that the work you're doing is high impact and aligned.
Yeah, I like that. Let me try to rephrase it to make sure I'm understanding. So rather than doing like a monolithic threat model of all the things, what if you were to instead do it? It sounds like almost ad hoc in terms of the development team is like, okay, cool. We're trying to figure out how we're going to update how JWTs work, or we're going to launch this new service, or we're moving into Kubernetes. We noticed that some of our scanners are giving us this annoying containers are running as root output. So maybe you have like existing security tooling. They're giving you some feedback on things maybe you should fix. Maybe it takes too long. But basically, development teams are trying to make a decision or thinking about doing a thing. You're getting maybe some feedback from security tooling. And basically, you're almost doing like a just-in-time threat model of, you know, for the tooling results, okay, like how does that fit into like larger risk and for things developers are building, you're almost like helping them make either architecture or technology, maybe languages, libraries, tools, choices in a way that hopefully helps them solve the problem better, but like also do it more securely, almost like an architect type role, but like security architect type thing. Is that close to what you were saying?
You may have used as much time as I did to rephrase. The So yes, a few things to say about that. One, if you're going to become an element of the critical path, then you need to start thinking about adhering to their culture. So rather than saying you have a release plan, stop, I'm going to threat model it, that doesn't sound very culturally compatible. Hey, you're doing, you know, sprint planning, and we see the need to promote this issue to a design spike. That's culturally compatible. Now, dealing with, you know, can I run this container as root? Yes or no? And if not, how? That's a design spike that fits naturally into the cadence. And again, it solves a problem that would have delayed them. This is where slip in development comes from. It comes from engineers not knowing how to accomplish a problem to everybody's desired outcome. So instead of it taking the sprint, it takes four sprints in a row. It was a hidden design spike. So culturally, you hit on it, right? What are the two impetuses of those design spikes? You get inbound from security and you don't know how to remediate that challenge. That's the tooling example that you described. And the other is you're looking at their actual backlog and you're asking the question, which of these realistically has either security, load and performance, or another non-functional aspect of it that's going to stymie them? And how can I get that speed bump out of the sprint plan? So, you know, you end up, it's not ad hoc at all. It's quite purposefully culturally tuned to the things that are actually happening. And right, where better, right? So let's say that you have an application and the application is 50, 100, a million lines of code. When you scan that with a static analysis scanner, or when you run dynamic testing, or you do IAST, or whatever it is you're going to do, you know, where is the bulk of the new findings? It's in the change set. And so whether you look at what they're planning to implement from a sprint perspective, or you look at the latest scan results, again, you're automatically focusing the security effort on the change set, on the things that are interesting to the business, because those are the things that are planned for the sprint, and where the emerging risk is going to be. There are exceptions, like when we find new ways to exploit old things. We decided that the password storage that's been in place for 10 years is no longer sufficient, and we've got to iterate that. But those are exceptions to the rule as opposed to the rule. Focus on the change, and you'll focus on the risk.
Yeah, I like that. And I totally agree with the how do we fit within existing development culture and processes and not be sort of an external force with our own timelines, approaches, and not speaking the same language. At least the companies I've talked with who I believe do this well and have been very thoughtful about it, I feel like pretty much 100% of them think that way. It's not always easy, but I think in terms of being maximally impactful and building strong bonds with your engineering customers, I would say, because ultimately security is trying to serve development, who is making the business actually make money, is a good way to do it. But okay, cool. Did you have a last thing you wanted to say? Okay, cool. So you highlighted an arc of four things. First one being threat modeling strategically. Second one, having security staffing being accelerants. Third one, moving from vulnerability discovery to guardrails, and then sort of eventually paved road and things like that. Okay, so we talked about the first one. I feel like my preferred means of communication is more like text, and I was kind of like, let me do a verbal table of contents. Okay, so you highlighted four.
Like write a newsletter or something?
So. It's almost like I write a newsletter, yeah. Okay, but yeah, let's delve into the second one, because I think there's a lot of meaty stuff there.
Yeah, so I mean, the example of threat modeling a problem instead of the application is directly an example of converting the security staff from AST babysitters to critical path accelerants. And it's one where you're dealing with architectural flaws, which historically we believe, you know, accounts, and Microsoft also believes accounts for 50 to 60%, depending on your counting method, of the vulnerability you're going to see in applications. You know, the other set of...
Sorry, what accounts for 50%?
Design flaws as opposed to, you know, the implementation bugs that application security testing can find. So, for instance, you know, application security testing is not going to reliably find the fact that you have an impedance mismatch between your security products, and one is using attribute-based access control and the other is using capability-based access control. And, you know, authorization inside of the downstream architecture is a goulash as a result. And there are plenty of edge cases where people can exploit for impersonation or vertical privilege escalation. That would be a flaw. No static or dynamic analysis tool or IAST is going to find that. So by threat modeling the problems, you tackle that set of challenges. But we, of course, know that even though the modern set of application security testing tools, both commercial and open source, has attempted to improve on the, you know, findings avalanche challenges, they still remain, right? Like, we're getting too many findings. We don't know which findings are the most important. We don't have the skill set to remediate them. So the second way that you can get on the critical path is to break the cycle of find, triage, and, you know, project manage the fix and figure out how to campaign the fix. So how many times do you need to find, you know, injection attacks before you decide to remove the inversion of control? That's where you take user data and then execute it, an eval statement, a shell escape, a runtime exec, whatever your inversion of control is. You know, you can find those SQL injection without parameterized queries. Like, how many times do you have to find that and triage it before you go, you know, maybe I'll take a different approach to this component? And this is where we got things like contextually aware output encoding libraries, on and secure by default, input filtration and escaping mechanisms. You know, for people who are as gray as I am, I actually have a full beard. You just can't see it because it's all gray. The static analysis results that we got in Java are profoundly different than the static analysis results we got in JavaScript. Is that a commentary on the intrinsic security of either platform? No, it's not. It's a reflection of the fact that JavaScript came later and the framework maintainers, some of which who reached out to me and my colleagues personally, said, we don't want to see that avalanche of findings from Spring. That's obnoxious. Help us fix that. And so they baked into their development framework those types of controls, contextually aware output encoding, you know, templating, you know, escaping. And so we don't see the prevalence of those vulnerabilities. Now, your organization may rely on a wealth of brownfield older stuff, or it may rely on new and sexy stuff. It doesn't matter. We know that we have a dozen, two dozen security areas: encryption, output encoding, input validation, authentication, authorization. We all know them. We've got to get all of those covered in each of our stacks. We've got to get each of those covered in all the stacks in the terms of the development frameworks that those stacks are using. So, you know, if you're running your 18th month of application security testing tool and triage practice, you don't need to spend a minute more, I hope, to understand what your problems you can campaign out are. You know what's bothering you. It's the things that are prevalent and high impact. So why not stop the hamster wheel of pain? I ate too much, I have to diet. And go build the muscle necessary to burn that fat while you sleep. To do the right thing, you know, from a development framework perspective, out of the box. And so this, you know, you can threat model a problem and you can develop a solution to unblock and accelerate the developers. You can also prevent the triage avalanche by simply making it impossible for the vulnerability to exist by campaigning it out with a hardened or a properly configured development framework or the introduction of an enabling security control. And so I there's a dramatic difference in the level of maturity that organizations that realize that achieve versus the ones that are stuck in the optimization of the AST approach. And, you know, the vendor space isn't helping, right? Because every 3 years, a new vendor will come along and say, we have the silver bullet to this problem. It's not SAST and DAST, it's IAST. It's neither of those things, it's CNAPP. You know, you eventually have to come to the conclusion that I'm going to stop this at the source of the problem by making it impossible for the mistake to occur.
Yeah, totally agreed. So there's two parts of this that I want to dive into. So the one is knowing what to focus on or maybe prioritizing, and then the other is like how to actually do the campaign. So you said you're running when you say AST, you mean application security testing tool, so SAST, DAST, IAST, things that are you
SCA.
run it and you get bugs or bad things back.
Yes.
So I think there's a lot of ways you could get signal on what to prioritize. So let's say you're running SAST and DAST and IAST, so you're getting some feedback from that. Let's say you have a bug bounty program, you're getting some data from that. Let's say you're doing regular penetration tests, you're getting some data from that. Maybe your business has, I don't know, certain priorities, either the development or the security orgs, either like quarterly or annually. So you have a bunch of different factors, but I'm curious for you where you would maybe start. I guess
Yeah,
another
that's a
aspect.
really hard problem, and I think it's one that's just like beset on all sides by peril, vendor peril, right? So not all sensors are created equal. And I mean, you work for a static analysis company. I've built, I think, six static analysis tools and taken them to market. So I mean, there's an obvious bias there's an obvious bias in this, but in this conversation, but SAST, SCA, you know, these are even the way that most IaaS are deployed, those are potential problems. That's the telemetry you're getting. These are potential problems or potential exposures. Now, you can do bug bounties and you can do penetration testing from external vendors, and then you're getting a different kind of telemetry. These are, you know, discoverable exposures and potential impacts. You know, these things collectively, from an industry perspective, contributed to the OWASP top 10, to the SANS top 25, to the ASVS, the Application Security Verification Standard from OWASP. But those standards are, you know, what we can detect with a fairly high level of automation. So I would say if you ran a security program, because if you're a practitioner, you tend to be in one of those stovepipes. But if you're running a security program and you're responsible for, you know, purchasing and administering those different, you know, stovepipes, you should rely on the, you know, the preemptive telemetry from static analyses because it's valuable. You should rely on the penetration and bug bounty signal as well. People poo-poo static analysis because they say it's not exploitable. So it's intrinsically less valuable. But there are things like the fact that your password storage algorithm is bunk that you're not going to find with a penetration test. And that is you're not likely to find with a bug bounty program. And so that's valuable to find, or that you stored a secret somewhere in the build process that you shouldn't have. Those are, you know, or that you have open source vulnerability that isn't yet reachable, but maybe soon. These are things you want to find with static analysis. So I'm sick of vendors saying it's not useful because it's not exploitable. It is useful. It's predictive. You know, like my blood pressure is elevated, so I'm going to change my lifestyle before I have hypertension. Think of it that way. It's useful, but it's not the end all be all. Penetration testing and bug bounty are great, you know, but they're reactive in as much as you have to wait for them to be found. So that's not optimal either. I go back to something that's a little bit more fuzzy. Once you rely on those two, you need the third leg to stand the stool up. And that's, look, back to the design. We all understand that we need a good encryption story that's going to drive privacy or integrity for our platform. What is it? We need a good authentication story, we need a good authorization story. We need a good, you know, audit and monitoring story on the back of that. We know, I mean, Christ, Ross Anderson wrote in the 60s. The set of things that would govern our security design as principles, we can apply those and ask the development frameworks on the tech stack I'm using, where are they strong? And where have they left something for the developer to do, which either the developer could screw up or just can't, you know, doesn't have the time to get to. And so I like, as a third leg of the stool, looking at security design principles and saying, I can audit my application. And I can move forward without the vulnerability telemetry. For instance, you know, if you're using JavaScript frameworks, you're really well covered around, again, output encoding and things like that. They're kind of bunk as it pertains to serialization and access control. If you're using Django, you got great, you know, CSERF protection, another token, you know, and encryption management flags. You can set that stuff up, but they have serialization and other challenges as well. You can audit as a security practitioner these frameworks and say, I know that I have 13 security principles I need some story about, independent of the threat model, independent of the defect, you know, discovery. I need a story about these things. And this tech stack and these frameworks don't have a story here. So I'm going to get on the critical path and build that before I have a bug bounty nightmare. And that's the part that people have been challenged by doing. And so that's where I typically go first. Look at the tech stacks you're using. Look at the dev frameworks that it has in play, and then fill the obvious gaps, because they're not going to go away through serendipity. And in fact, when I teach threat modeling, I teach all kinds of risk and attack-oriented modeling. But another thing I bolster it with from the other side is, you know, there's going to be intrinsic gaps and vulnerabilities in your posture because you've analyzed the frameworks and you understand what they have and haven't done. So that's the challenge. The challenge, of course, being that that's not something we have a tool for. So guess what gets ignored?
Yeah, I was actually going to dive into that, like double click on that, zoom in. So I think there's two parts to that that stick out. So one is, so I've chatted with people at a number of companies who are like, yeah, my company has hundreds of repos, thousands of repos. I think this visibility, understanding like which languages, frameworks, and things like that your company uses and with what prevalence and what is their relative impact. Like, okay, we see, you know, these repos use Express or something like that, but maybe those are just small internal services, whereas our public facing, like big things are all Java Spring or whatever. So like, I think it's maybe not just number, but also importance of the relative things. But I think getting visibility into what you have and their relative importance at like a language and framework level is not obvious. And then the second part.
But here's a good homework assignment for all y'all security practitioners out there that are like, yeah, but I don't have that telemetry. Go get it. You know, you can script very easily with Bash, PowerShell, or Python, you know, ripping apart your ADO, your GitLab, or your GitHub, pulling the information that those collect about the repos. And collecting the information where it doesn't exist, because even if you're not building S-bombs, you know, you have a requirements.txt in your Python things. You have a, you know, I mean, you have a package.json, like the data is there. So if you don't have that telemetry, get on the critical path by going home tonight, cracking yourself a beer, and then building that script and generating it. And that will tell you really interesting things.
Okay. So in terms of like tactically doing that, you would say like your SCM provider potentially already exposes some of this metadata, or you could just clone a bunch of the repos down and grep the like manifest files essentially for what dependencies they declare.
And once you get really sharp with your homework assignment, you can trundle over to the platform engineering team and have them implemented as a template action that goes as part of all of the newly forked, you know, GitHub repos. And you can have a web service that pulls that data back to your sweet little, you know, Lambda function and database, and now you've got security telemetry that you've built. So the number one reason why we have a skills and experience gap in the security practitioner space is because security practitioners are too reluctant to just dive in and code. Everything I just described is less than 3,000 lines of code, you know, if you take it in bite-sized chunks. And so the number one thing I tell everybody, regardless of seniority, is do not be afraid to dive in and code it. Just code it. It can be ugly, but, you know, you know, when I think about the podcasts that I listen to and the people who are most frequently invited to speak on those podcasts, I sense that there's a very common theme that these are people, regardless of their role, that rolled their sleeves up and wrote some of that code in their environment, gained some of those insights that were readily available but undiscovered, and then acted on them from a programmatic perspective.
I like that. Just while we're on the topic, are there some podcasts that you particularly like that are high signal that you think people should know about if they don't already?
No. Your newsletter. I'm not going to show anyone's podcast here. I think my reading and my desires are too academic or esoteric for. But
okay, so you're maybe like tier one security conferences. You're like that.
I don't think at this point I even understand how I collect my material. I have a million browser bookmarks. And I think it was akin to the way you do TLDRSec. It's like, I don't know, I got this big sweep in and I have, you know, I have a sniff test for the, I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that question. I literally use your newsletter.
Okay. Well, there's a lot of other good stuff out there, but I appreciate the compliment. Yeah. The two things that I was going to call out first, like how do you actually gather this data? We just talked about that. The second is you mentioned understanding the gaps in the frameworks or tooling that you use. So for example, you're like, okay, cool. We have Django. It does great on these things. It doesn't do it on these. What about for Express? What about for Spring? Like all the things. And I've noticed that too. I guess what I'm trying to say is it seems like a lot of duplicate work from a bunch of companies who their internal teams are all having to replicate that work. And is there like a single place or a set of places where you can easily just get like the TLDR, like this is what this framework gives me, this is what this framework doesn't give me? Because I probably like,
no, maybe Sigil had an business internal idea. Maybe thing. I can create a dev framework nutrition label and, you know, have a consumer labs for it. That doesn't exist. And again, it's not SBOM because we're talking about,
yeah, that's different.
We're talking about the security principles, in the way that the developer engages the framework. What I train people to do when I train them to do threat modeling and they do the framework analysis piece of the threat modeling is just go to the framework maintainer's website. They love to brag about how secure they are. So there will typically, like in Django and Spring, there's a security tab, you know, there's a change list, so you know what they're working on. There's like a framework, so you know how they think about it. It's actually very easy to extract this information from a reasonable, you know, reasonably maintained frameworks documentation without even going to the source code. However, you may have to go into the source code to understand the impedance mismatch between it and your world. So here's a slide that I used at an OWASP keynote and that you've seen and that you've used things from as well. I know you think this way. When I think about security, I think about the scope of security, again, from Ross Anderson's secure design principles perspective. You know, and so again, you don't need to pick a formal framework. You can pick whatever you want. You can base it in CNCF framework. You can, you know, but again, there's encryption, authentication, authorization, input filtering. You know, we know what these, you can look at the ASVS and the table contents of that. There's a security framework. That's one axis. The other axis is in the frameworks we are using, how does this framework engage that security concept? So is there no protection and the developer must implement it, you know, whole cloth themselves? For instance, authorization and access control in Django, there's nothing there, you know, and same with Flask, right? Like there's nothing there. So you're on your own. So you as a practitioner know if you're looking at a Django app, authentication authorization is a place to start because it wasn't provided them for free. Now go to the bottom, right? You're using Java and Spring, you know, modulo the fact that they've managed to blow their toes off in places. Buffer overflow is a solved problem because the platform, the Java platform provides memory protection. Terrific, right? So those are the ends of the spectrum. And everywhere in between, you have, you know, some amount of effort that the developer or that the security, you know, practitioner is going to have to engage. And it's a continuum, right? Do the number of levels here matter? Do the specific ways I've broken them out matter? No. But somewhere in between, you have a situation where you know, it's not platform provided, it's not on and secure by default, but there's some discretion. You know, there's some facility and some discretion, and now I've got a, these are places where enabling security controls are, you know, are great additions for those people who want to get on the critical path. You know, build yourself CSERF protection. Now that's done, you know, but build yourself the protection that's missing, and then find the way to push it as far down the stack as you can so that it's as mandatory and as difficult to disable as is possible. You know, we saw this when in output encoding, people had libraries, but you had to remember to call them everywhere and you had to call them in the right context. And then people realized, Christ, there's nested contexts. So we built templating engines and then we made it secure by default. And then we said, now you got to turn it off and we're going to embarrass you to turn it off by making the flag to turn it off. Like, I am a bad person. This is insecure, you know? And so again, the detail here doesn't matter, but what matters is, once you have your 13 or so security principles, you can grade them in the tech stack that you're working with against whether or not you have to deal with them and then how you're going to deal with them. And there's an analog to this chart, which is not how the security control works, but how the security control governance works. So once you know that you have something that's developer discretion to implement because you wrote a cute library, now you need a static analysis rule to make sure that they actually called it everywhere they were supposed to call it. And that's a great use of static analysis, a way better one, you know, than pointing out that they called a bad function. So this is why, you know, I love on the governance side of this dice to say, So you could say, look, you know, turn static analysis from a vulnerability, quote unquote, vulnerability avalanche into, you know, guardrails, because once you start to use it to make sure they haven't turned off the secure by default and they have integrated the enabling security controls and discretionary controls, then you've created guardrails and then they get an attaboy or attagirl for doing the work as opposed to, you know, something that probably isn't exploitable that they have to worry about arguing not to fix. And, you know, again, that changes the relationship you have with engineering. So that's a key concept, but again, it requires that you think about getting on the critical path and committing to making sure those things work and they're pushed down the stack to secure by default or on, you know, platform provided, as aggressively as possible, which is, you know, substantially more challenging than reading your checkmarks results and complaining that they didn't fix them, hypothetically.
Yeah, totally agree. And just to like reemphasize something you mentioned, because I feel like it's very insightful and critical and something I've mentioned in a couple of talks over a number of years, but this idea of, I mean, ultimately, security is not like, let's find all the vulnerabilities. We're trying to ultimately allow the business to succeed by having functionality that works at a acceptable level of risk. And ideally, we can make the risk go down, which, you know, you could try to find all the bug whack-a-mole things, or to your point, you could try to eliminate classes of things from happening in the first place. But the thing I wanted to emphasize is, it's just, like, rather than finding, so for SQL injection, for example, like if you're like, okay, cool, where all the user input coming in, it's getting passed to here, to here, to here. Okay, eventually there's an unparameterized SQL query. Like, there's a lot of reasons in practice where, you know, static analysis engines are, there's inherent imprecisions, like Rice's theorem, like halting problem. Like, there's reasons this is hard that we don't need to get into now. But basically, like, while that is very hard and potentially prone to false positives, if you're just looking at where are all the unparameterized SQL queries, you can get that right basically 100% of the time with like a very simple analysis, because you just like look at it right there. It's like probably a little bit more than grep, right? You want like some like awareness of source code, and you don't want to write like super gnarly regexes, though you probably could if you wanted to. But like basically, like if you're just like, hey, like when are we setting this, you know, disable CSRF value to false, or when are we like disabling CSRF? When are we doing an unparameter SQL query? When are we doing things that are just like, yeah, like just don't do that, I think is a very nice.
Well, dangerous functions are the easiest use case for a static analysis tool. The way that the security posture works in practice is it's layers, right? So you need to understand what the Nginx config looks like. You need to understand what the route table looks like. You need to understand what the Django controller looks like. And then you can assert something. You just cross three files and languages. So when you think about how to detect whether a control is in place, it's rare in practice that the control would be at the tactical level of a line or a function. It's more likely, in my experience, that it will cross those layers. But that doesn't mean you cannot use, you know, static analysis or rudimentary unit testing to find whichever your pleasure is, to define those things done correctly, or to point people at how to do them correctly. Again, to me, the key is that the way I would put it is, it's easier to find ways to prove that a developer has remained on your paved road using your enabling security controls, configuring the frameworks correctly, and following the things you know to be good security posture, than it is to prove the security posture does or doesn't meet an acceptable level, right? That's the thing with vulnerability, you know, discovery tools or application security testing tools. They're pretending to try to prove that something is or isn't secure, and that's a substantially more challenging problem than we've thought about this deeply. We understand the threat model. We're not going to bother you with it, but we've imbued that threat model onto guardrails or onto a reference architecture. And that reference architecture isn't pie in the sky diagrams. It's the specifics of the frameworks you're using, their use configuration and settings. And we know how to detect whether you stayed on the paved road. And you don't have to stay on the paved road. This isn't fascism. But if you do, we have a hell of a lot less testing to do, because there's this many classes of problem that we know get X'd out. And, you know, when you look, again, across the board, from the ISVs and tech companies to the finance, to the insurance companies, to safety, that it's that paved road approach that's sort of flexible and resilient. They have a robust mechanism for security governance that's painful, and they have an alternative that's rather smooth in a paved road that they've put substantial thought into, but they no longer need to impose friction because of, because the questions go away. You know, so, okay, well, if you're using our OpenShift, which, you know, uses our container delivery platform, which delivers things as non-root, then we don't have to ask or answer those questions about whether or not, you know, an escape exists in the application or what its impact is once you escape it. So we have minimal namespaces and we own privileged containers. Super. Is the risk zero? No, but I had to ask a lot fewer questions. And so that to me is a very commonality, you know, between the mature firms and the immature firms and the people who live in the black and white world of my tool finds stuff best, or I've got to go find all the vulnerabilities and fix them. That's a losing proposition by comparison.
Yeah, I love that. I think there was a talk from some people at Netflix who basically the idea was, you're a developer here, you can do whatever you want. These are the set of sort of security controls or hardening steps we need if you're going to launch something in production. So you can either use this paved road we've built for you, which is basically like include these two lines in your config file or like fork this repo and build from there. Or here's like 30 things you're going to need to do yourself. So you can do those 30 things yourself, or you can like get to writing code.
There may be a very valid reason why you've got to bushwhack, but you know, most people in our firm won't want to bushwhack. And I mean, this is the strongest argument for tools like yours, right? In the way that I've historically used the commercial tools, the paved road is necessarily tech stack and organization specific. It's an embodiment of the risk tolerance and the tech stacks that are in play. And so being able to customize your analysis to determine the extent to which the car is on the paved road is the killer app. And, you know, that's why, in my opinion, SEMGREP has gotten traction, because it has democratized the ability to write custom rules. You know, whereas the commercial tools, you needed some sort of wizard hat and sort of, you know, animal sacrifice to get a custom rule to work.
And there's only so many animals.
I mean, cats reproduce really rapidly, but.
So just to quickly, like,
recap, we ended a SEMGREP
recap
commercial on animal sacrifice. Go, John.
Yeah. I don't want any, one of the reasons I wanted to chat with you is because I feel like you keep it real and tell it how it is, without regards for, anything else, which is what I appreciate about you. So we talked about, like, how do we, go from sort of babysitting tools to actually accelerating delivery. We talked about how, like, okay, well, first, in order to know where to start, we need to understand our environment. You proposed writing some custom code, maybe integrating with SEM providers like GitHub, GitLab, or just like Bash that's like grepping a bunch of manifest files like package.json, requirements.txt, basically like figure out what you have. And then second step, understand what those frameworks give you by reading their documentation. Generally, they'll have a security page. So this next part that you talked about a bit ago, like, okay, then you have like these campaigns where you're like, okay, cool. How do we actually partner with engineering teams? One thing you mentioned, I think teaming up with the platform engineering team, we can also delve into that because I think that's like one of the best judo moves I've seen from any security team. But I guess my question for you is, or maybe to take a quick back. So let's flash back 3 years. Clint is very blissfully naive about the world, even more than maybe today. And I've been trying.
You are really blissfully naive. You just play well on TV.
Yeah, it's all acting. Yeah. As soon as I get off camera, I'm just like.
I want to see the grizzled Clint TV show, by the way. Sorry.
Yeah, sallow eyes, jaundice. Basically, at first, I was like, okay, like I'm hearing from all these people at very forward-thinking companies about how sort of secure defaults and paved road are the way. And I thought, clearly, if I just have more people hear about this, clearly they'll be like, oh yeah, this is the way I should just do it. And what I've come to realize is that, like, yes, some people haven't heard about it. Some people need to be convinced, but there are a lot of people who have heard about it, are convinced, and not just ICs, but let's say like director, VP, even CISO. So they have like decision-making authority within their organization. But I found even in those cases, even at companies where the security leader believes in it, has some political power, also it's like even a tech forward, like eng first company, still this idea of like paved road and guardrails can be hard. And a couple of ideas or a couple of reasons or ways in which I've seen it be hard are like people not knowing where to start or what to focus on, or maybe like politically there's some challenges. But I guess I want to hear like
the answer is already in my commentary. Like it's not a secret, right? The reality is that most security practitioners and executives are afraid to roll their sleeves up and actually do on the critical path. So where they do end up creating something, they create something and then try to partner with engineering to adopt and implement it, but they've already lost because they created something and now they're trying to sell it. This is like a security startup, which I got news for you is challenging, right? So the better way to do it is to think day zero about the critical path. And you can do that by asking to threat model the problem, the design spike, or offering to do the thing they cannot do. Hey, we're doing API scraping, and the APIs we're scraping use MFA. How are we going to control for that securely without defeating the MFA and providing, you know, value and automation to our downstream API customers? Sounds like a great problem for me to jump in and solve. You know, it's prescient to the business. It's on the change set. Like, that's how you answer the question. The way I've seen this work well is when you have product security engineers. They may be paid for by the security executive, but they're embedded in the engineering environment. But they have to, like, the constitution or the Bible here is the backlog. It's not your own security agenda. It's what is the set of things that the developers are going to slow down because they don't have answers to. It has to be that. And, you know, that means two difficult things for security. To the executive, it means subjugating the people and the objectives to the engineering critical path, which should be the point. And it means that the engineers are going to have to get in there. The security engineers are going to have to get in there and maybe look like they're not as good a developer as the other engineers. And they typically shy away from that, in my experience. But, you know, they know things the engineer doesn't know, and they can accelerate that piece of it. And every time they win, they're going to win big, because they will have improved their credibility, they will have improved their skills, and they will have delivered something. So I think the answer is actually dead simple. I think we've given it many different ways. I think that the problem is implementing it. You know, it's not like bodybuilding is hard to figure out. It's just that you have to go to the gym every day and you can't eat that pizza. Like, it's hard in the implementation, not in the design. And I think security engineering is the same way. But, you know, we see the rays of light, and it's not the train. I mean, I know more and more CISOs and CTOs who have become individual contributors at the likes of GitHub and other places because they weren't afraid to do this. And I'm sure everybody listening knows one or two people they admire that's done the same thing. I think the only reason I'm relevant with this much gray hair is because I continue to write tens of thousands of lines of code that, frankly, some of my customers use in production every year. You know, and there's only one solution to the problem. Get in there and do it. So I feel strongly about that. Is it scalable, John? You know? Yeah. Because, you know, you don't have to be a rock star. Most engineering teams have really mundane problems that they simply don't have the staff or the security awareness to solve. And it's not as scary 2 inches from it as it is from maybe 100 yards.
Yeah, and the code doesn't need to be perfect. I mean, if you're like, hey, engineering team, you have this painful, annoying thing. Here's like my code that solves it, albeit crappily. And they'll be like, okay, cool. Like, I know how to write good code. Your code already works. Let me just rewrite that as if like a senior person had written it, which, you know, they can probably do in a fraction of the time from creating it from scratch.
Right. I mean, the blank sheet of paper problem, right? You've solved that for them. So, yeah. So when I build security champions programs and when I help product security engineering teams, that's the challenge.
Yeah. There's a couple things you said that I wanted to delve into in a little bit more detail, just like very quickly. So first off, you said like, okay, don't build this thing in isolation. Because if you build in isolation, you're like, hey, I built this thing. Engineers, can you please use it for me? You're arguing that's hard. It's basically a sales problem. And like startups are hard. But instead, take what's in their existing backlog or existing problems that they're having and then solve those and then be like, I did this thing for you.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm manic in that I advise startups and I advise CISOs. So I tell every startup every week that I advise, you know, you have to solve these questions, answers at the customer site. I don't believe that you can sit in your garage, as I'm currently sitting, and build the solution to something and then pitch it to somebody or demo it or put it out there on the net and expect traction. it doesn't work that way. And it's the same thing with, let's say that you got it perfectly right and you're a security champion or an SSG member, software security group member. You got it perfectly right and you're going to go walk across the hall and get them to implement it. It's still not in the sprint plan. Right. So, so you have to start from their sprint plan. Again, that's the root. Like, that's the Constitution. That's the Bible, whatever. It's God's truth that they care about these things. Like, so if you can affix to those tickets, then you're going to, you know, it's self-selecting, right? If you can't, then it's a sales job. So I mean, you know, from a personal perspective, if I'm going to consult with somebody, I'm like, I need access to your ADO board. I need to see what you're working on. I don't know how I would do my job without access to your ADO board. And I don't feel like the average security champion behaves that way. And I think it'd be a simply accomplished and huge upgrade.
What is ADO again?
Azure DevOps.
Okay.
It's like GitHub, but banging your head against a rusty nail.
My favorite. I think I'm Leaf. One of my colleagues and friends actually gave a talk when he was still at Segment/Twilio about, basically, it was a B-Sides SF talk. I think the title was something about, like, you know, security teams plus product managers, like, working together effectively, something like that, about exactly, like, getting in on whatever, like, tickets are assigned for a given sprint or things like that.
And here's the other thing, you know, how many security people have you heard complain like, man, they really boffed this. They should have talked to us. Okay. They probably didn't know that it was a security problem, right? That knowledge is in your head, not theirs. So if you were on the backlog grooming exercise and you were on the sprint planning exercises, they explained the tickets, suddenly you have visibility into those things that they were, you know, hiding from you. They weren't hiding them from you. They were just doing their job. So a lot becomes sort of virtuously correct when you meet them on their side of the river. And what does it take? I mean, you know, if they're actually doing it correctly, it takes you what, like a 30 minutes, an hour every 2 weeks? Is that really a high investment cost for you as a security person? You know, I don't know. Again, a lot just sort of evaporates in terms of barriers when you sort of go to their side of the river.
Yeah. I agree. And I like this a lot. One maybe nuance or counterpoint I was curious about your thought on is, so let's say, you know, the engineering team is currently working on these things, but as a security org, you're like, okay, I have different priorities, different visibility into, like, these are the things that are potentially most risky to the organization or have caused security issues in the past, specifically at this company. And, like, that's not currently what they're working on. So it sounds like you're like, okay, let's work with what they're currently working on. But let's say the biggest risk, valid, the things that are going to bite you are not those things. Like, how would you handle that?
So let's divide those into two categories, right? One will be hygienic. Like, you're abysmal at injection attacks and those need to be eradicated. So that's a hygiene problem. The other is, like, the way you're doing access control is foundationally broken. And, like, the way that the zero trust people over there in the cloud are thinking about it is also busted. So that's an enabling security control or an architectural flaw issue. So if it's a hygiene problem and you're like, listen, the poor hygiene is causing systemic vulnerability that produces organizational risk, I think you have to campaign those and you say, listen, you know, we're going to need 20%, we're going to need 10% of the backlog bandwidth. And in every sprint, we're going to plan that 10 or 20% is going to be hygiene improvement, right? So, like, you know, my kids won't go to school unless they brush their teeth. You know, like, we won't do a release and introduce a new injection problem. And we won't do a release without removing two. So I think those are sort of a different modality, absolutely. And you can deal with that. And, you know, organizations have typically not had a problem where they're able to articulate that, you know, an endemic hygienic problem demands fixing. Input validation and output encoding were a few of them. You know, failure around authorization is another one, but it's more silent because the tools don't see it. In terms of the enabling security control when they're off or they're sideways, that's challenging. That requires... In my experience, that's the one that does require real seniority to come in, and say, okay, so we have a zero trust initiative, but really this is just about network security groups. And we have this bigger problem where, like, we don't understand factor zero for, you know, NPEs. And so we don't know what code is calling what code anywhere. And so we can't have zero trust because, and that is a situation where you end up in a longer cycle, you know, typically with enterprise architecture around, you know, around sort of a longer term multi, you know, multi-phase campaigns. In the larger banks that I work with and the longer, you know, like product security companies, it's best then as a security person to affix yourself to some, again, critical path. That critical path is typically some initiative. Like, we're replatforming from, you know, Intel to Apple Silicon, and we're going to solve this problem on that replatforming initiative. You know, or, you know, we're moving from AD in the data center to AD in Azure, or, you know, we're swapping out SailPoint for, you know, ForgeRock or whatever. Like, you've got to affix yourself to something that they're doing and say, okay, so I have a multi-year, multi-phase initiative and you have one of those. And what I'd like to do is, you know, talk to you long enough that we understand how to do your initiative better, and maybe even faster. But I've got to fix this train car to it. That's frankly, most of what I do when I advise CISOs. I end up the emissary to their development executives to overcome the credibility gap and to do that alignment. That's what I love doing. I think that's, you don't need me. You know, what you need is a relationship with the development executives, you know, and the patience and the courage to build that rapport and do that. But that's like any, you know, those of you who are listening that are in large organizations and understand how cross-departmental stuff works, you know, that's the difference between you as a successful individual contributor and you as a, you know, distinguished engineer, you know, or somebody, a staff engineer, right? That level that's necessarily muxed on to, you know, and Jesus Christ, how many times have I heard podcast people be like, you know, why are you a staff engineer? Oh my God, I hate when they answer that question. I think one of the answers to that question that I don't hear is because I'm able to tell somebody outside of my department that we need to make a direction shift and I'm, you know, reasonably successful at doing it 2/3 of the time and hooking my train to the, you know, to their wagon and, you know, getting a different result. That to me is what determines a staff engineer's effectiveness.
Yeah, that's huge. Same shameless shout out. My friend Rami interviewed a bunch of people who are staff level security engineers at a number of companies and put those on into a sort of a guide on TLDRSec. So if you want to read what a bunch of people, how they got to where they are and their thoughts on it, there's like 8 or 10 of them or something that are there. We could keep chatting for many hours. I really enjoyed it. And I feel like there's a lot of great insights there.
I'm super glad we were worried about what we would talk about on this.
Yeah, we're like, are we going to have enough 10 hours later? So you mentioned a potential spicy take before the call that, I don't know, do you want to wrap up here or would you like
to? I don't even recall what the spicy take, I'm like a, whatever it is, like a gnat, like it just goes in one ear and out. It's like, I can't remember what.
Oh, you were talking
about.
You mean
spicier than I think staff engineers are completely delusional about what gives them value? I don't know, that was a pretty spicy take.
That's a good one. We'll pull out that quote and put it in isolation.
To use SEMGREP effectively, you have to sacrifice a cat. I mean, just, I don't know, man. There's going to need to be a...
I think we can wrap up here. John, my friend, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for your time. I'm sure we will hang out again soon. And yeah, thank you for watching it, everyone, whether that's on YouTube or I think we're going to put this on Apple or Spotify as well. So feel free to leave a comment, like, subscribe. I think the YouTubers are saying, you know, smash that subscribe button and all such things. But yeah, have a wonderful day.
Likewise, everybody. Thank you for listening. And would love to engage on, not on social media, but would love to engage on wherever, LinkedIn, if you have comments or questions or discussion. Clint, it was as always a pleasure this time we recorded it.
Yeah, thanks.